come on in.
And now, back to the Bill Frank Radio Show.
The kids love him.
And your host,
welcome to paradise,
Bill Frank.
Welcome back. So much of our country's attention has been focused on domestic policy since the Great Recession of 2007 to 2009. The foreign policy has taken a backseat to the recovery and the implementation of Obamacare. Yet it may be foreign policy that defines the success or failure of President Obama's administration. The U.S. response to such events as the Arab Spring, the nuclear buildup in Iran, Syria's repressive regime, U.S.-Russian relations, alleged NSA surveillance of Germany and Great Britain, and Sino-American relations will have profound effects on the United States' relationships with the rest of the world that last long after the memory of the Great Recession has been forgotten. Joining me to discuss how U.S. foreign policy may be abandoning our allies around the world is Bruce Hershenson. Bruce is a Pepperdine Senior Fellow and an author. He was the Republican nominee for the U.S. Senate against Barbara Boxer in 1992. Bruce has received the Distinguished Service Medal. He served as the Deputy Special Assistant to President Nixon, and he was appointed to the Reagan Transition Team. He's the author of the book Obama's Globe, A President's Abandonment of U.S. Allies Around the World. And if Bruce's name sounds familiar, it's because he was a fixture in Los Angeles television for 14 years, engaging in spirited but respectful debates with former Senator John Tunney on KABC on an entire range of political issues. Joining us from Pepperdine University. Hi, Bruce. Welcome back to the show. How are you?
Thanks. Real good, Bill. It's good to be back with you.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you with us because we've got so many new headlines coming our way. And I just want to start one that is ripped from the headlines.
Okay.
60 Minutes this week reported that the United States had multiple warnings before the attack on Benghazi in Libya on the anniversary of 9/11. Mm-hmm. And despite the warnings, the U.S. didn't increase security at either the barely protected diplomatic outpost or CIA headquarters, which were located blocks away. We were ignoring these mounting signals of an imminent attack. To me, that indicates a systemic breakdown in U.S. diplomatic outposts. So I guess the question that Americans are going to be asking, with whom does the blame lie? Does it lie with the State Department, the Department of Defense, or does this go all the way to the White House and ultimately to President Obama himself?
In my view, you've named them all. They're all to blame for this. And it's now over a year since this happened. We don't know how many times Ambassador Stevens requested further security. We know of more than 12, and I heard one report of 16. There's no way for me to know. At the same time, we do know that it is confirmed that there have been requests, and that was done by a State Department official at a hearing and said yes, they were rejected. That's before the attack. During the attack, we know very, very little. We have not implicated any particular people, even though we do know names. The media has recited those names. We have photographs. After the attack, we do know we were either told it was definitely inaccurate information, and inaccurate information not only by UN Ambassador Susan Rice, but by the presidents of the United States. We know that. I mean, that is absolute fact. We have the videotapes. There was a debate with the president and candidate Romney in which the president said on the 12th, on 9/12, I said the attack in Benghazi was done by terrorists. No, he didn't. Anyone can have that transcript. Just ask for it on the web. You can have the transcript. I have God knows how many copies of this thing because I've taken them to school and I've given to students who didn't recognize that he was saying something inaccurate. On September the 12th in the Rose Garden, he talked about terrorism. He's correct on that, but it was about terrorism on 9/11 of 2001, not of 2012. And also he again said it was on the 25th of September that he talked to the United Nations and said that the attack was made because of the videotape that was on YouTube.
All right, Bruce, but that's the president, and the president has been elected for a second term, so he's gone. I mean, this will have domestic ripples, but it will not impact President Obama being reelected or anything like that. However,
well, but when you say anything like that, Bill, anything like that is history. and will impact that.
That's where I was coming to.
Right.
I wanted to talk about the implications that this has with other world leaders who watch mm-hmm. our president making these statements,
mm-hmm.
which turn out to be patently false.
Yes.
What impact does that have on other world leaders who are watching these events unfold?
They can't trust him. And they don't trust him because of that and any number of things, because he's seen us abandon our allies. President Mubarak of Egypt, three decades supported the United States against the terrorists, maintained diplomatic relations with Israel, really maintained peace in the Middle East for three decades. And we dump him. We say he's got to go. Ben Ali in Tunisia is what started all of this. It started in Tunisia, what is called the Arab Spring, and has been anything but. We told him he's got to, when I say we, I mean the president, that he's got to go. Well, he was an ally of ours. Now, I realize these are monarchies. These are, you know, these are people who keep their office for decades. But that's the way it is in that area of the world. Other than Israel, that's the way it is no matter what country you're looking at. Now, what are we going to do about that? Tell them they got to go. They got to go in a free, fair, and democratic society. None of them have it. They may call for some elections, but elections are the last thing that you do to build a democracy, not the first thing.
All right, but let's talk about countries where we do have a direct hand in what's going on in their
okay.
government, and specifically, I'm speaking to Iraq. I mean, the United States has, in my opinion, been abandoning these former allies simply because the leaders weren't nice guys.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe I'm wrong in that, but that's my impression of it.
Okay.
The reality is, though, what does this mean for the democracy, the fledgling democracy that we're trying to establish in Iraq when they see us abandoning Egypt, Yemen, and the list goes on and on?
Well, you can add the fact that they see them being abandoned themselves. Iraq was abandoned. We've left it. And Iraq now has more fatalities every month than it did when we were there. It is going. It is leaving any possibility of having a free and fair and democratic election or anything that they should have had prior to it. Once we left, we abandoned Iraq. Wars are not ended by ending them. They're ended by winning or losing them. Always. And that's always the way that it'll be. Winston Churchill said, wars cannot be won by, what was the word that he chose?
Retreat.
I believe that is correct, yes.
Evacuate. Actually, the quote was, wars are not lost when you evacuate.
Evacuate. That was the word I was thinking.
All right. Well, let's talk a little bit more in depth about this, though, because I'd like you to clarify, if you will, for my listeners, this violence that you talked about in Iraq, and it's really springing up throughout the Middle East. How does that exemplify U.S. foreign policy over the last 5 years? And in fact, what has been the U.S. foreign policy towards the Middle East over the last 5 years?
To abandon our allies. And you find that King Mohammed in Morocco and King Abdullah in Jordan know that they can no longer count on the United States. And of course they can't count on the United States. They saw what we did to Ben Ali and Mubarak, and even what we have no doubt tried to do with Israel. When the president begins a speech on the Mideast and says that he would like the 1967 lines used as a basis for an agreement, good Lord, what he's saying is, I would like it to be used, that the basis be used before Israel won the 1967 war. That's something we don't even say to our enemies. We don't even say that to Vietnam. North Vietnam certainly has the territory that was called South Vietnam. We don't say, hey, give it back to the 1975 lines. We trade with it. We have diplomatic relations with the Socialist Republic of Vietnam. So even to our former enemies, we don't do that. But to our current friends, we do. We want you to go back before you won the war.
Well, Bruce, and my guest is Bruce Hershenson. Bruce, that brings up an interesting point, because President Obama comes into power, and before that he was a junior senator. And as a junior senator from Illinois, he was responsible primarily for domestic issues. As President of the United States, interestingly enough, the role reverses, and he's no longer truly involved in domestic issues as much as he is in international issues.
You are so right.
So going into this, was President Obama just naive? When he took the role of president, did he not understand that his role was changing? Was he unaware of the fact that he was now going to have to be involved in these international affairs? And how did he prepare himself for that role?
I obviously cannot tell you what was going on in President Obama's head at the time. I do know, however, and I have to give him this, I do know that many people have entered the office of the presidency not knowing that they are the ones who have the final jurisdiction over foreign affairs, and the Congress has the final jurisdiction over domestic. Very few exceptions. There are some, but very, very few. And a lot of them go into the office promising all kinds of wonderful things they're going to do on domestic policy. I think you recall that President Clinton came into office about what he was going to do about health care and appointed his wife as the head of what we called for short Hillary Care. It didn't pass the Congress. But when he wanted to go into Bosnia, he just went into Bosnia. Kosovo, he goes into Kosovo. Fine, I'm giving him credit on that, but that's his job. Haiti, he goes into Haiti. More troops to Somalia, he does it. He found out, as most presidents do, that that is the stuff of presidents. The other is the stuff that you talk about, unfortunately, to an electorate that really doesn't generally know what the job is of the President of the United States.
All right, Bruce, but let me take this one step farther if I can, because President Obama or any president comes into office and he may or may not know the role of the president in foreign affairs, but he's supported, he's flanked by the State Department. These are senior diplomats. These are career politicians. These are career public figures that are guiding our foreign policy. Now, the president gives them orders, that is true, but the reality is they are the ones that are out there implementing it.
You bet.
The State Department, how do you think they view our foreign policy, not only in the Middle East, but around the world? And what advice did they give to the president to help guide our foreign policy that would make for a smoother transition rather than these abrupt starts and stops in countries like Libya?
I can say with absolute accuracy that they have probably guided President Obama on the path that he's on. Most presidents find that the State Department guide them terribly, and I'm starting with Harry Truman, and they disregard the advice because they know foreign policy as well. But with President Carter and President Obama, they love the advice they get from State. State, remember, is a department that wants to negotiate. They're diplomats. They believe they can negotiate with tyrannies. You cannot negotiate with a tyranny. You can negotiate with a friend or even someone who at times you may not regard as totally as a friend, but isn't a tyranny. But you cannot negotiate with a tyranny. They have no problem in violating any agreement that they make. And State believes that you can talk to anyone. So they found someone who they could put their arms around when he even campaigned, saying that he wants to be able to talk to the Ayatollah in Iran. He wants to be able to talk to al-Assad. They love it, and he loves them, and they give him the advice that he wants. The State Department has also been anti-Israel since there's been an Israel.
My guest is Bruce Hershenson, author of the book Obama's Globe, A President's Abandonment of U.S. Allies Around the World. But let me zero in on the State Department, because State was headed up by Hillary Clinton, handpicked by President Obama to run that organization. In fact, she was there at as the head of state when the Benghazi situation occurred. So back home, what effect is these new revelations going to have on Hillary Clinton's presidential aspirations?
I think it'll have a tremendous effect. And I think that probably, if I could just sort of look into the future of what will be on television in 2016, I would assume that over and over and over again, we will see the tape of her saying, what difference does it make? She's talking about the raid on Benghazi. She's She's talking about the murder of Ambassador Stevens and John Smith and Doherty and Tyrone Woods.
All right, I'm going to switch gears, and I still want to stay from rip from the headlines if we can, please.
Okay.
And I want to talk a little bit about the NSA surveillance that we've got. You know, Edward Snowden, who's the NSA surveillance leaker, he became this pawn in foreign relations when Russia gave him asylum. And now the press is describing relations between President Obama and Russia's President Vladimir Putin as chilly. And Putin, we must remember, is a former KGB leader and a Russian hardliner. So my question to you, Bruce, is this. How has Edward Snowden's impacted U.S.-Russian relationships? And in what ways has Putin been able to exert Russian power in the world in ways that Nikita Khrushchev was unable to do by banging his shoe at the U.N. in 1960?
This is the worst leak, if you want to call it a leak, in our history, that Edward Snowden has obviously informed, well, by this time, the world, and is continuing to inform the world and make it extremely, extremely easy for someone like Putin to be much more of an authority because he now has that information as well. Bill, I have never understood how anyone could have voted, no matter if they love the guy, and I'm talking about love the guy being President Obama, how they could have voted for him for a second term after seeing a videotape on television in which he is sitting opposite President Medvedev and saying to President Medvedev that when Putin comes into office as a president again, that I can be more flexible with Putin after the election. He doesn't even tell the American people that he'll be more flexible with Russia. He tells them secretly to tell Vladimir, is the way he used it, tell Vladimir I can be more flexible after the election. How could you vote for anyone like that?
Well, let's continue on that thought for just a minute, because then Vladimir has this information, and that gives him a certain level of power,
of course,
which he's exerting in the whole Syrian situation and
yes,
our foreign policy towards Syria. So describe in a little detail, if you will, how President Putin has taken away power from President Obama in regards to Syria and the chemical weapons debacle there.
Sure, and he's been an ally of al-Assad for many, many years, even during the years of Soviet Union. And I think that it has to be understood that right now what we're doing is negotiating the do-away with the chemical warfare material that has killed 1,400 people. But we are not negotiating or doing or condemning al-Assad for the death of over 100,000 people. We are saying that the chemical weapons will all be destroyed somewhere in mid-2014. Well, that gives al-Assad a great deal of time. In the meantime, he's getting compliments by the United States. He got a great compliment by Secretary Kerry in Bali in the conference there of APEC. A great compliment by saying that we have to compliment what al-Assad is doing. No, we don't. Al-Assad is using time. He's got now till 2014, till the world is bored by talking about the over 100,000 people that he killed and saying, gee, isn't this great? He's turning in all the chemical warfare materials.
Well, Bruce, I've got to stop you right there, because haven't we seen this movie before, and don't we know how it ends? Because during the President Clinton administration, we know for a fact that in Iraq, the chemical weapons were used against the Kurdish people in that country.
Yep.
And yet we did nothing during that time frame. And then some, I think it was 7 years later, we end up invading Iraq, and it's our longest standing war to date, over 11 years.
Yes.
It seems to me that we're going down this exact same path, and yet we don't seem to realize it. Am I just wrong in this, or are we just headed towards another long extended war?
You're just right in this. That's exactly what happened. I would even go further. It wasn't only weapons of mass destruction used on the Kurds. It was used on the Shias, and it was used on Iranians during the Iran-Iraq War. We've seen it used by Iraq countless times during the past decades. We knew there was weapons of mass destruction. Where did they go? You got me. But they went somewhere, probably to Syria.
My guest is Bruce Hershenson, author of the book Obama's Globe, A President's Abandonment of U.S. Allies Around the World. And Bruce, Machiavelli once wrote that it's better to be feared than it is to be liked. So when it comes to foreign policy, is the U.S. trying too hard to be liked?
Yes, absolutely. And the quotation that you just gave is so accurate. So accurate. In World War II, we were feared. And I have to say that we were feared under Clinton in Bosnia and Kosovo recently. We were feared by our enemies all over the world. Good. That's what it takes. When you're not feared, as we were not feared during the Carter administration, and not feared certainly now and not feared, you lose. And you lose something that is so tremendously important. You lose the conflicts in a war between the United States and those other people who want freedom against those people who are being persecuted by totalitarian governments.
Well, Bruce, let me ask you, though, this, because we lose a lot in the conflicts themselves, but aren't conflicts like the ones we've engaged in Iraq and Afghanistan, aren't those really won or lost on the home front, just like Vietnam was? When public opinion turns against those conflicts, then it really doesn't matter what military might we have. We end up losing those wars.
Well, it can take a president with a heck of a lot of guts and a lot of courage and just do what has to be done. And when you say, like, we lost in Vietnam, in truth, we won in Vietnam in January of 1973 with the Paris Peace Accords. But part of it counted, and we put it in writing, on our president giving a one-to-one, called a peace-to-peace revival of any assets that are lost if the North Vietnamese by any chance violate the agreement, knowing full well that they would. Our Congress wouldn't do it. Ford was president at the time. Our Congress refused to give the aid that we promised South Vietnam. They received the warning on April the 10th of 1975 from the president in a speech to a joint session of the Congress that unless they gave what we promised, South Vietnam would fall and so would Cambodia. Before the month was over, Cambodia fell on the 17th, South Vietnam on the 30th. Fulbright made the statement, "I am no more concerned than I would be if Arkansas lost a football game to Texas." And that's how we lost the war. We lost the war because the Congress wanted us to lose. And that's the 94th Congress, and every word I'm telling you is absolutely true. Anyone can check it for themselves these days.
And I believe it. My guest has been Bruce Hersenson, author of the book Obama's Globe, A President's Abandonment of U.S. Allies Around the World. Bruce, what did you get out of writing this book?
I suppose I got rid of some frustrations more than anything else. It was not a pleasant task. I love to do stuff where I compliment a president. And I'm talking about whatever president, even if it's a president of the other party, when they're good. But this was not good. It was my hope that this would help achieve a defeat of him for his second term. Obviously, I was wrong. It didn't do that. All it did was get rid of some frustrations, and I now have it in writing. At least it'll be on a shelf someday for some kid who's studying foreign policy and wants to go into foreign policy. Some things that I know are accurate, and I give the information for anyone to look it up. Well, the reason I tell you that a speech by President Ford was April the 10th of 75 is because anyone can now look it up. Google it. Just put Ford speech, April 10, 1975. You'll find it. It was given it in the evening, prime time. And the Cambodia fell on the 17th and South Vietnam on the 30th because they couldn't get anything from the U.S. after we promised it. And I want to add one thing to that, Bill. I said, and the reason I started talking about this is because of a question you asked about the people being opposed to a war. The president even has power over the people. I asked former President Nixon, what would you do if the Congress had refused aid while you were president to either South Vietnam or to Cambodia? He said, I'd bomb the blazes out of Hanoi and Haiphong. And he said, maybe I'd get impeached for doing it. But so what? I would have saved millions of Southeast Asian lives.
And we're going to have to leave it there, Bruce. It has been a delight. Thank you so much for being my special guest here on The Bill Frank Show. We'll talk to you down the road.
Real good, Bill. Thank you.